This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Next year, we'll mark 50 years since the court-ordered forced integration of the Boston Public Schools. And a coalition of several dozen nonprofit leaders and public leaders has laid out a learning agenda between now and then, especially given both the scars from busing and the extreme segregation still present in so many Massachusetts districts. Actually, the first public forum in that journey is tonight at Roxbury Community College. So today, two leaders join us to talk about the history and a piece of it, a successful and voluntary one called METCO. Michael Curry, CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and a member of the National Board of the NAACP, and Lyda Peters, longtime Boston educator, civil rights activist, university professor, both here in studio too. Michael, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
And Lyda, so nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to start, listen, a year-long journey, right, as part of a 50-year now almost journey. I have to believe that this, in fact, Michael, at least for you, I know that this starts from a personal place. And I want to start there. And Michael, I'll start with you. How does this start from a personal place for you?
Yeah, so of course, I've been a part of many conversations over the years about busing. Horace Small, who used to host one at the Union of Minority Neighborhoods, we had a series of conversations. They're all caused me to reflect back on the 17-year-old boy that I was, that was being bused to from Roxbury to the Warren Prescott in Charlestown. They caused me to reflect back, Lyda, on the fear that my mother had putting me on the bus those mornings to head over near the Museum of Science and take that right turn over to Charlestown and to pass through that gauntlet of anger and violence and police that were trying to protect us from that violence headed to the Warren Prescott. I remember, even as seven-year-olds, and it's not a lot of reflections we have as seven-year-olds, but you know trauma, you remember. You know violence, you remember. So this is personal for me because I often have wondered, and I'll make this comparison, and people may not like this comparison. I often wondered when I looked at pictures of lynchings during this country's history, and I saw the faces of the families, the angry mobs around the bodies, and I would say, I would love to have interviewed them to understand what was in their heart and their mind. The same is true for busing. I'd love to understand what was in their heart and their minds when they stood out on those streets. And this project that we've been doing has allowed us to have those types of conversations.
Lyda, I just want to invite you in here.
All right. What hit me when you talked about understanding the hearts and the minds takes me back to when it first started. I worked with Ruth Batson. I worked for Ruth Batson. And so during that period of time, I was 20.
So, Ruth Batson, an organizer, one of the co-founders of METCO. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, more than that, she was chair of an education committee that actually started desegregation. And the desegregation movement was a movement because there were so many parents in the streets that wanted their kids, like your parent, to have a better education. Not a segregated education, not a poor education, not an education in schools that were old, that would fall apart. And by the way, I taught in one of those schools at the age of 22, I think I was. So the issue around desegregation is much, much deeper than a bus. I think people have heard that expression, the issue is us, not the bus, because busing has become such a stigma. Then beneath that stigma is a movement that was about goodness, better, force, opportunity for Black kids who were in schools that were overcrowded. I taught in those schools. I taught in the first grade, where kids were not seen, Black kids were not seen as educable, where Black kids were seen as coming from homes where parents didn't care. So that fight for desegregation of the schools actually started with Ruth and the Education Committee, Ruth Batson and the Education Committee. And if it wasn't for organizing in that Roxbury community, we'd have the same thing that we have right now, a segregated city in Boston. And that fight was so critical for people like you, kids like you, to know that the world was different, that the schools that you went to, although, as I understand it, the schools that you were bused to weren't that great either.
Right.
I understand that now.
Yep.
But there was something different. You had teachers that were recently out of college, and they were more experienced. I shouldn't say recently out of college. They were more experienced than the teachers that I was 21 years old. So when I went into a school, I had something like 42 first graders. That was a black school. In the other schools, you didn't have that.
So we're speaking here in Studio 2 right now with Lyda Peters, a former Boston Public School teacher, now a college educator, longtime activist, and Michael Curry, one of his many titles, is on the National Board of the NAACP Board of Directors. Tonight is the first in a series of forums over the next year, looking at the history and the legacy of desegregation, organizing, and busing, which happened. That was a court-ordered moment in 1974 that was the result of about a history of social activism towards desegregation. The first event is a public event that's free that happens at 6 p.m. at Roxbury Community College tonight. Michael, I want to pick up on what the two of you are saying, and I want to make sure that listeners who weren't there don't and can't discount the level. You talked about lynching, and I want to make sure people can't discount that. Yeah. I'm going to play two pieces of sound here. The first is from founder of the base, now the head of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Boston, Robert Lewis, talking on our air back in 2019. We were having a conversation about busing them. Then here he is.
What folks don't realize, there were a bunch of black families that lived in East Boston. So I was one of those black families that lived in East Boston. So as busing was coming to bear in East Boston, my family was firebombed out. And I was one of 20 black families that got firebombed out because busing was having an effect at our high school. But all of a sudden, the issue of race was taking effect for us black families that lived in Maverick Street housing development, Orient Heights. So I moved out, you know, our family moved to the South End. And then I get a letter that says, I am getting bused to East Boston High School.
Oh, my gosh.
The community that I was raised in as a one-year-old up until 16.
So his home was literally firebombed. Mm. He moves out, and then he's bused back to that community. Now, I'm going to put next to it a piece from a conversation in April. We spoke with best-selling author Dennis Lehane, who grew up in the area. He's written a new book. It's called Small Mercies. He situates it in South Boston, a white community, in the summer of 1974. And he makes a scene out of a memory he had driving through. His father takes a wrong turn driving through South Boston in the summer of 74.
The life-size dolls are hanging from the flagpoles and lampposts now with signs around their necks. One reads Senator Kennedy, another Judge Garrity, a third Mayor Kay White, and a fourth William Taylor. The men who carried the effigies stand below them with lighters in their hands. As the crowd bellows its approval, they light the dolls on fire. It takes a minute. The flames dance along the edges of the effigies, some blue, some yellow. One of them, Garrity's, goes out, and they have to start again. But then the light from the flames washes over the crowd closest to the courthouse. It bathes them in red and yellow and blue light that floods their heads and faces like liquid.
I want people to understand the level of intensity that we're talking about, Michael. And I apologize if it feels like I, who wasn't there and being voyeuristic in a moment that you grew up in, but I don't want people to be able to discount it. And I want to pick it up from there, because somebody might say, wait, why do we need a whole year leading up to the 50th anniversary? But that's why we need a whole year, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's so much here. I reflect back on turmoil and transition in Boston, Larry DeCara's book. Larry, who I know well.
Former Boston City Councilor, ran for mayor.
Yep, ran for mayor. And in his book, when he shared his book with me, was the piece that talks about Whitey Bulger had planned to attack those buses of kids coming into South Boston, right? And there was really a group of folks who had to engage him to stop him from perpetrating that kind of violence. The reality is that this is no surprise, right? Racial division in this country goes back to at least anti-black racism goes back to 1619 and the arrival of those slaves. We've had many occurrences in our history where folks have come in as immigrants, white immigrants, and competed to be included and transition and matriculate into this society. And black folks that they've been at the bottom of the pile, though many of us got here before many of those immigrants did throughout centuries. And then as a result, the tensions rise. So I think about Red Summer in 1919, the racial violence across this country way before Tulsa, Oklahoma. So it's no surprise that Boston wasn't immune from that. We had tensions here because though white families were poor and were going to bad schools, they weren't as bad as the schools black children were steered into. So whether it's bad housing, black families were steered into bad housing that were worse than the housing in other communities, and we were steered into bad schools that were worse. This was about access to all, that if I pay taxes, if I live in this city, my kids should have access to the school systems that are here and not be relegated to the worst systems and the worst institutions. And that's our history here and across the country.
And I want to pick up there, Lida, because I also think it's important for people to understand that the history of activism that the black community was engaged in, this was the backdrop in which it was happening. You know, when Kirsten Greenidge wrote the play that came out in the summer of 22, Common Ground Revisited, which took the famous book Common Ground and reconsidered it. And not without controversy as she was developing it, she actually added Ruth Batson as a character into that play. And took a look at what it meant to be advocating for desegregation in the 60s and into the early 1970s. You worked with many of those activists as a young person in your career. Take us back to that time and what it meant to be agitating and advocating in that, in what we just heard from Robert Lewis.
Yeah. Well, one of the things before I do this, and I know we're limited, is to let everyone know that this segregation in schools started in 1787 with the first black people who came. And at that time, to speak about activism, they were active, a small group of people, but they were constantly active, trying to get their kids into schools that were open to other kids. That's something that's systemic. And that's something that did not disappear by the 60s, by the 50s, by the 40s, by the 60s. So that by the time I was involved in that, there'd been a number of groups throughout the city who were parents, primarily parents, screaming as loud as they did in 1787 and on, screaming to say, we want our kids to have an equal chance at a good education. These places were overcrowded. These teachers were understaffed. These teachers were new. As I told you, I was 20-something, 21, 22, when I started teaching first grade with 40 kids. The books were terrible. Some of the books were racist. G. McGuire has a picture of that. So at that point, when I got involved, I was involved with Ruth, who was pretty much the leader of this whole movement. And I learned a lot about what you do, not how you cry, but what you do to change things. And it was more than just walking. It was organizing. It was meeting. It was talking to parents. It was holding those kids. It was trying to find alternative schools so that kids wouldn't lose their lives over that period of horrible period of time when they were not getting any education in Roxbury, getting little to no education in Roxbury.
So you mentioned Jean McGuire, and I think this is an opportunity. And listen, I'm going to pull back the curtain a little bit, the fourth wall. Amanda Beland is the producer on this, and she's in the other room. Amanda, we did a book a little while ago on workers, black workers in the 1800s here in Massachusetts that looked at organizing around schools. And if you could pull up that name later in the show, I'll give that to listeners, because we covered some of this in the 1800s there. But, you know, Jean McGuire, longtime leader of METCO, and I think this is something, Michael Curry, this is where we can start to bring that in. So METCO's formed in 1966.
Yep.
voluntary program that actually does give kids in Boston an opportunity to go to schools for a solid education and does real integration, which is not just take kids out of segregated schools and put them in other schools, but bring kids together to encounter and learn from each other. I think there are 11 schools originally. Talk a little bit about that model, Michael Curry.
Yeah, well, one is I think we've always had this situation in our history, and Boston is no exception, where when systems didn't allow us in, when they didn't offer us equal opportunity, we had to find alternatives. And METCO was an alternative. It was an opportunity for some kids, not all. I would make the comparison to sort of charter schools now, right? They become an alternative for a percentage, a small percentage of some. It's not the solution, but it's a solution for families. My sons went to METCO, two of my oldest two sons.
Mine did too.
And the creation of METCO gave them a chance to go to schools where my son was sitting in classrooms where the academic rigor was there, the social supports were there. They were more better financed school systems, quite frankly, because the infrastructure of our educational system in urban areas is underfunding, is under resourcing then and now. And therefore, we're at a competitive disadvantage to a Cohasset, to a Lincoln Sudbury, name the community. So my kids got a more academic, rigorous education in those communities. We have to embrace and celebrate METCO and the program that it was. But I will tell you, as a person who did trainings in METCO for years, they used to invite me in to do trainings with the young people. They were dealing with trauma too. Racial isolation, racial incidents in these communities across the Commonwealth. They were dealing with in some cases, racist teachers and racist administrators, because they're not immune from that either. So there's been advocacy by parents and administrators and METCO coordinators to fight for even in those systems to treat our kids well so that it didn't break them. So while we celebrate METCO, we have to be honest about what it was and is as well.
So we'll take a quick pause there. We're speaking with Michael Curry and Lyda Peters. Tonight is the first of a series of forums over the next year looking back on the history of the organizing around desegregation and busing. The book I mentioned, by the way, No Right to an Honest Living, The Struggles of Boston's Black Workers in the Civil War Era by Jacqueline Jones. You are listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we're here in Studio 2 continuing our conversation with Lyda Peters, former Boston Public School teacher, civil rights activist, professor at multiple universities looking at education, Michael Curry, member of the NAACP, National Board of Directors, head of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, also a member of the Desegregation and Busing Initiative Committee, which is launching a year-long look at the history and legacy of busing. The first forum tonight at Roxbury Community College. It's free and public at 6 p.m. Lyda, we've been talking a little bit now about METCO. Mm-hmm. Begins in 1966 with seven communities like Lexington, like Newton, others, a couple of hundred students. Now we're looking at 3,000 students across three dozen communities, high demand, 33 districts around Massachusetts. Complicated because it works, meaning students have strong outcomes, families are satisfied with it. When it had wait lists, which were recently in the last couple of years eliminated, huge wait lists. In 2019, 15,000 kids on the wait list. That's up from 10,000 in 2016. And yet, Lyda.
And yet, the idea that students or their parents want them to continue to go to another place to be bused, to get up early in the morning, to take that long ride.
Hour-long ride for my kids.
Yep. long ride. I used to be the medical coordinator also in Newton, so I understood firsthand what that experience was like. First, what I want to say at that time was that there were very few black kids. There were 220 who started, then it grew. But when I went into a classroom, I would see maybe two or three black kids with maybe about 13, 14, 15 white children. And one of the issues that I would have to confront would be that some of those black kids would be sitting in the corner, not getting the same exact education than the others. Parents would have to go in and fight. Metco would have to go in and fight. I'm not sure what it's like now, but always fight on behalf of their kids, even though they were in these very elite schools. These were very, very good schools. And so the fight never stopped. I mean, the fight continued. And when I say fight, I don't mean it with an emphasis on anger. I meant it with an emphasis on parental force to say, my kid deserves something better, even here in the suburban school. It worked because many of the children, they're not children now, many of the adults that I come in contact with, all talk positively, not about their experience, but about where they are now. And if they hadn't gone to that school as opposed to the Boston Public Schools, they wouldn't be where they are now. So that's the reward of the sacrifices that they made during that period of time.
So, Michael Curry, I'll play you a little sound here, a conversation we had in 2019. And of course, I'll mark a lot of this sound we're playing is from 2019. And a lot of that is because COVID happened in 2020, right? And derailed so much of what we thought we were doing in education and how we did it. We were talking to Tashana Bailey, who's a Metco parent and former employee in the Arlington Public School System, also a former Metco student herself. Here she is.
Our students that come in have to work a little bit harder. We have to, you know, get up earlier. Our days are longer. So it's more stressful on the students. And sometimes if they're struggling in certain areas, I just think the system is quick to just automatically put them on an IEP versus really taking the time to give them extra support.
Now, your head sort of snapped up at that, Michael Curry. And there was an episode of Chronicle that looked at this and underscored the fact that, for example, African-American boys are more quickly put
Amen.
Into IEPs because of learning styles and racism and prejudice versus taking the time to understand what the learning needs are. So again, I want to emphasize this tension, right?
Yep.
Working. But what does working mean, and why are we using a model that takes kids, puts them on a bus at 6 a.m., takes them to a suburban school where they are othered still to some extent, and yet if it's working, quote unquote, why aren't we doing more? I mean, this is a really complicated situation, Michael Curry.
Yeah, I mean, it is working, but it's not, right? The reality is that my son had an excellent education at Cohasset, though it traumatized us as a family. We got a call every other day about his behavior. Whenever we would go meet with the administrators about his behavior, it was never about his academics. So it was never about whether, hey, he's improving in math, he's doing great in this area. And it, for me, it was IEPs. Well, we think we should put your child in IEP. Those were some really tense meetings. And I think you could poll Metco parents. And you hear a lot of those stories, particularly with our black boys, as I was putting a black boy through the Metco program. I can say that and still say that when he left Metco and came back to a Brockton public school system, he was in all honors classes, though he would have never been in all honors class within Metco, within Cohasset. So the academic rigor did prepare him to come back and compete within a public school system. I want to reference two people. One, Monique Marshall-Veal, who used to bring me in because I used to do trainings for black students on predominantly white campuses in college. The isolation, the feeling like you represent your race, the being spotlighted by a teacher, all those issues that happen on a white college campus happen in Metco. Do you need to comb your hair? The ignorance that happens around our race and culture, students are having to deal with that at a very young, impressionable age. College, they're not even really able to deal with it. So she would bring me in to do sessions with young black, brown, and boy girls to talk about what that's like. The other person is Jessica Tang, the head of the Boston Teachers Union. This is about traditional. Boston Teachers
Union. Boston. Okay, thanks.
This is also about traditional public education. Most of our kids will not go to Metco. Most of our kids will not be in charter school. We have to make sure the masses of black children, brown children, are getting that level of academic rigor and excellence in our public education system, our traditional public education system. So I celebrate Metco. I know what I went through, so it can be improved. But it can't be the model for how to teach our kids. It has to be an example. that can be improved, but the traditional public education system is where our focus should be.
And I want to, Mark, I apologize for starting to correct you on something you knew better than I did. I apologize
right.
for that. So you did two things there, and I want to break them apart because I want to do both of them. And the first is the experience both in high school or and primary school and then college of being a Black student in a white environment. And I'm going to pick that up because, Lyda Peters, you have also taught at Boston College. I was on faculty at Boston College for several years. Another place, and you know, Boston College has been known for a long time as a white university where Black students feel othered. And I wonder, going from a public school teacher to a university, you know, sort of your reflection on that across that landscape and whether that weathering is helpful or just sends kids to college even more weathered than they would be otherwise. Do you understand my question? And it may be an ignorant question. I want to acknowledge
well,
that.
Well, sort of. But one of the things that you have to acknowledge is that when you come from a good high school, you get the doors open wider.
Yes.
That's very clear. I used to teach classes that had to do with African-American history. And my class would be filled with all of the Black students who became friends, and they would tell me these stories about what went on in other classrooms and how they got here. But for the most part, at BC, they had prepared them with certain programs that they had. They weren't very happy, but you couldn't get to a school like Boston College. You couldn't get to a school like Boston University unless you came from a good school that had prepared you, no matter what your SAT scores
yes.
were. You had to have a school like that. So Boston wasn't preparing people. I mean, the history of Boston, going back to attorneys that I know that are now my age, talked about the kind of poor education, but the kind of racist education that they got. And this I'm talking about in the 60s, 50s, 60s. And that if it wasn't for the surrounding community, the activists there, the men who reached out for them and to them and supported them, got them to Black colleges in the South, they wouldn't be the attorneys or the
yes.
judges who they are now. So the school itself is a pivotal point in the lives of every child. And Metco is that pivotal point for many because Boston, unless you're in Latin, and they've minimized
Boston
the number
Latin
of kids.
School.
Yeah, Boston Latin. They minimized the number of kids, the opportunities for Black kids to get into there. So other than that, you've got to be in a school to get you further. And going further, by the way, also means that you think about yourself differently. When you sit in a seat where a teacher in a elementary school, a high school, dismisses you as if you don't exist and reaches all around you to the non-Black kids. That in itself is a way that's a message that's coming to you that says you're not worth much. You put them in an alternative school. Some of them I don't like, but it's an alternative. And you put them in an alternative school where they are learning more than they did before, and they know it's hard, but they make it. That's a new person, especially when they have parents.
Yeah, and just a quick point to that Professor Peters makes. We have to draw the connection that if a student isn't allowed to be his or her best self in school because of the systems, because of a teacher, self-fulfilling prophecy, that notion that people talk down to you, they treat you
right.
as if you can't succeed. And we
right.
do that in our systems.
Right.
We don't see them in the C-suites. We're not seeing them in the medical schools, the law schools. We got to make that connection as we have the DEI conversation that we're missing.
Right.
And we're missing from the table. And if, as a good friend of mine said, you're not at the table, you're on the table, you're on the menu.
Right.
When you're not there to be in the law school, on the policy, on the admissions, on the curriculum, we're missing for a reason because, as Professor Peters said, the system set up from the beginning to keep us out. And that's not conspiracy theory. That's history. That's our context that we're talking about.
So, Michael Curry, mindful that we've got about 2 minutes left, two factors I want to just ask about quickly. One, this year, METCO level funded in the state budget for the first time since 2018. Second, a series of court challenges challenging racial awareness in school decisions. Now, Lawyers for Civil Rights head Ivan Espinoza-Madrigal has suggested publicly that the changes, for example, to Boston Latin School admissions probably fit within the U.S. Supreme Court ruling as it stands. So maybe something like a METCO is okay, and yet we see those challenges out there. What do you think the landscape in the last minute and a half is for the next, 24, 36 months?
Yeah, well, I think all of us who are students of history know that there are ebbs and flows of history, right? There was a backlash to emancipation, right? There was a backlash to the civil rights movement. We're in a phase of another backlash to progress. And that Supreme Court decision of affirmative action, what we see the governor in Florida doing is all the backlash. It's so funny when he says we don't want people to be woke. I'm like, when did being awake was a bad thing, right? To be conscious of American history, which in within that is Black history. We are in an all-out attack on racial justice, on inclusion, on diversity. This is just another piece of it. I think Yvonne is right. I think we're in a better position here in Massachusetts. We have a higher consciousness, but we're not absolved. There will be people who fight inclusion, who challenge inequities, and who don't fund METCO. The reality is we need those 200 legislators in that building to understand that that is the pathway for so many of our kids to medical school, law school, to success, to entrepreneurship. Don't close that access. Fund it and fund it well.
All right. Michael Curry is the president and CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and a member of the national board of the NAACP. Lyda Peters is a professor at Boston College, has also taught at Cambridge College, a longtime Boston educator, civil rights activist. Tonight, Boston school leaders will be giving a free discussion on the history of METCO and busing as part of a larger look at the history of activism around desegregation at Roxbury Community College. The event begins at 6. Thanks so much to both of you for coming in.
Thank you.
In the first part of this year-long learning process.
Thanks.
And one more thing for you listeners. If you want to learn more about this history of busing in Boston, you can also read more by visiting our field guide at WBUR. That's at wbur.org/field guide. And we'll have more field guide for you in just a minute. We are going to take a look at the latest biography on the iconic and, honest to God, iconoclastic Isabella Stewart Gardner. That's when we return. I'm Tiziana Deering, and you're listening to Radio Boston.